Welcome to the Dildork, Storky Discourse on Sex, Dating, and Masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and I am definitely an anxiously attached person. Who are you, friend?
I'm Bex. I'm a sex educator and a blogger, and I'm drawing a blank on the name of mine, but it's fine because we're going to learn all about attachment very soon, so it's fine. I'm the one that gets a different name in every goddamn book. It's fine.
Our guest today is someone we've been excited to have on for a really long time to talk about attachment theory, among other things. Can you please, Ida, can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do?
I certainly can. My name is Ida Mandule. My pronouns are they and them. I'm an activist, I'm a trauma-focused therapist, and a sexuality educator. And those are only a couple of the things that say what I do in the world. Another part of my interest is in community justice and accountability. So all, you know, a lot of things around how we can be and feel better in our bodies and the world, and centering relationships at the core of that.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And I've seen you teach about a bunch of things. Most memorably for me was seeing you talk about anarchist dominance and submission at Woodhull, because I feel like that just like blew a lot of things wide open for me in terms of like thinking about DS in a bigger and more important way. But today we're talking about attachment theory, which like we've gotten like a number of requests to do an episode about attachment theory, and like I didn't really know that much about it aside from the fact that like I'm definitely anxiously attached. So can you give us like a quick overview of what attachment theory is and why it might be helpful to know about this stuff?
Totally. And, you know, just a reminder that this is my version of it. This is a distillation of mm-hmm. not just what I've seen in my work, but also some of the theory that's out there. And, you know, all theory is up for collaboration and debate, certainly. But the main mm-hmm. idea is that attachment theory espouses is that we work to connect to people in our lives as adults based on what we learn and how we learn to connect as children. And usually there's the language of primary caregiver, which is sometimes assumed to be a parent, a mother or father, something like that. But I like to expand that a little bit further to both be, you know, relevant to a lot of different audiences, but also a lot of different cultures and backgrounds. Not everyone has a primary caregiver, or a mother or a father. And so the idea sort of as a bigger thing is, you know, you connect to the people when you're an adult in the ways that you were taught to connect when you were a child. And that the ways that we bond mm-hmm. emotionally or physically to people sets up a framework or a blueprint to how then we will attach to other folks in our lives. And attachment theory also talks about there being a biological drive, an innate drive to connect to other people, especially when something is going wrong or we're alarmed or we're distressed. And it brings up this idea of secure versus insecure attachment. And secure attachment is not just about, are you chill in the face of distress, or are you feeling okay in your relationship? That's a pretty superficial understanding of it. Secure attachment is about having the ability to explore as well as have a secure base to come home to. Again, whatever home means to you. So you can be by yourself and also be with other people, and that both of those states are doable for you rather than being really distressing. And when we talk about insecure attachment, it means that there is some kind of interruption in that process. And so maybe you're really comfortable with exploring and being by yourself, but you're deeply distraught when you have to be with other people or rely on other people or have them rely on you. Or maybe you're super freaked out by being alone and by being exploring in this, you know, wide world by yourself, but you're totally chill in relationships with other people and can really attune to what they need from you and about you. And so that's the main gist of it. And so it comes up a lot when we talk about couples therapy or anything like that, because at its core, what we're talking about in couples therapy or relationship consultations or things like that is how we bond with each other, how we relate to each other. And so attachment theory for me has been a way to understand some of the underlying dynamics of how we make those bonds happen and what are the things that freak us out in those bonds, and then how we can, you know, fix them or address them to better relate to each other.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. I think it's really important and really interesting And one of the things I love about the way I've heard you talk about it is that I think, I mean, even the language they use between secure and insecure, folks with insecure attachment often are written about as like, or talked about as like broken or damaged or doing it wrong or needing to be fixed. And I like that in the things I've heard you talk about in attachment theory, you talk about kind of how all of these different attachment styles have pros and cons and like might be helpful to move towards a more secure, but that doesn't necessarily like you're not broken and terrible if you're if you fall into one of the insecure attachment styles that we'll talk about a little later.
Exactly. I actually hate I hate when people talk about, oh, this is just, you're insecure, you're broken, this is terrible. I'm like, no, first of all, no. Second of all, no. And, you know, part of that's my training. I'm a social worker. I was taught strengths-based approaches. And it's not just because I was trained in that I believe in it. I just think that that's a better way to approach the world, right? If you, mm-hmm. if you have a conversation with someone and you're talking, you're probably going to have way worse results if the first thing out of your mouth is, let me tell you how you're wrong and broken and how you can be fixed.
You'd be amazed how many people
at the same time, some people, right. No, exactly. I mean, so many therapists do that too. And I mean, to be fair, right. To be fair, some people, when they've been told that story, when they've been told that they're broken, they will go in search of people that will echo that back to them and tell them, I can promise how to fix you. I can promise to fix you and tell you how to do that. And so that's something that I also see in my work, not just as a therapist, but also as an educator, is people coming to me with that narrative and asking for a solution and a fix because they're bad. And sometimes you have to meet them where they are with that and sort of start gently reframing and start gently changing that story, because if that's the story that they come in with, they're also not going to be receptive to me just being like, no, you're not broken, you're okay, everything's fine. Like, that's not going to be helpful either.
Yeah.
Right. Well, so like, even though obviously people who are insecurely attached are not broken and there's nothing necessarily wrong with the way that they choose to relate. Like, I definitely feel like I am insecurely attached and it does cause me distress. It does cause some friction in my relationship sometimes. So I guess, like, my question is, like, is there anything you can do to fix it or to work on it? Because I've heard about what's called, like, earned secure attachment. And I would imagine that earning secure attachment is a lengthy process of self-examination. But, like, what does that process look like?
Right. And maybe before we do that, we can actually talk about the different kinds of attachment.
Yeah, I think that would be great.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because especially if listeners are like, who am I? What is this? It might be helpful to do that. But, you know, spoiler alert. You know, it's not the worst thing ever if you're insecurely attached. I myself have been insecurely attached. I'm here to talk to you about it. And so in terms of the different kinds, right? So the literature talks about secure and insecure attachment. The literature historically has been pretty cis, straight, white, all these different, you know, normative communities come to the fore. But we can still use it, right? I don't primarily work with cis, straight, heterosexual, white, able-bodied couples or anything like that, but there's still a lot to be gained. We just have to be critical of the literature. Mm-hmm. So that said, you'll find secure and insecure. The idea of a secure attachment is where the person can build intimacy with quote-unquote relative ease. They don't worry about being alone. They do seek connections, but they also have their own thing going on. They have their independence, and they generally have a positive view of themselves and others. To be quite honest, I have very rarely met people who are just securely attached right out of the gate. And I think that that's important to say, right? Because if we're aspiring to secure attachment, I think it's really important to keep in mind that most people, even if the literature says, yeah, there's a lot of people who are securely attached, I kind of don't believe that. And that's where I will critique the research, critique the methods, critique the communities that they're looking at. So that little tiny soapbox said, for someone who's securely attached, when there's distress, the general way that they respond is, you know, they feel the distress, there's some level of anxiety, they try to resolve it by seeking connection rather than running away from it. and then they receive a good response, right? So that relies on someone else giving them a good response too. This is not just an individual thing. And then they reach a state of balance and reach a state of chill. If you are insecurely attached, there's three primary flavors. Depending on what you're reading, you may find different words for this. That's okay. That just means that, you know, the world is vast and we have different words for things. That's not a problem. Mm-hmm. So we have three primary types. One, I would call anxious preoccupied. The next I would call dismissive avoidant. That's me. And then we have fearful avoidant. Which if you're looking at literature for children, and sometimes for adults, they might also call that one disorganized rather than fearful avoidant. So with anxious preoccupied, people who have that one or that primary style will maybe have nervous energy. They will want intimacy and they will want other people's approval, sometimes to a point that it freaks other people out. It might turn into dependency. They're often afraid of being alone or being left alone. So the fear of abandonment is pretty big. They might also fear being rejected in a way that can be sort of quote unquote more than usual. And you may also find that folks with anxious preoccupied attachment also seek reassurance a lot. So their cycle, you know, distress and anxiety is the beginning for all of them. And they also seek connection. So right here, we're up to the same path that the secure people have. Mm-hmm. But when they've sought connection, they've gotten a bad response. And so they don't get to chill. They don't get to have the balance. And so what a person with an anxious, preoccupied style does when they get that bad response is they seek connection again. And they seek mm-hmm. it again and again, even if the response has been bad. Mm-hmm. And we can contrast that with dismissive avoidant, for example, who, when they feel distress and anxiety, they might seek connection. They might not. And generally, they also have had a bad response in their history. But instead of them seeking connection again and just trying over and over and over, they give up and they fling themselves into the sun and they suppress the hell out of everything afterward, which is me. So if, you know, because there were ways in which I did not receive certain kinds of emotional support, I was like, oh, cool. You're not going to give me that? Well, fine. I'm going to give it to myself. I don't need you. Let me be really independent, which can be really helpful in some ways and, you know, help us survive, but it doesn't ultimately lead to better and long-lasting relationships. So the dismissive avoidant, which I just started talking about, which is my the style that I was raised with, that kind of person can be really confident and independent. At the same time, they can also be totally freaked out by intimacy. It feels really important for them to be self-sufficient, to be independent. Their biggest fear is having other people controlling them or hampering them or depending on them. And some of the strategies that they use to deal with the world and deal with these distressing thoughts or feelings is suppression and distance. So they are the ones that maybe run away from intimacy, or they're the ones that if you're having an argument, will need to go into another room to cool down, and will want to be by themselves because that is actually how they have learned to feel better or to manage really overwhelming emotions. Mm-hmm. Whereas the anxious preoccupied seeks more closeness. So you can already tell that if you have these two together in a relationship, that might be a little tricky because one person wants to be left the heck alone and the other person's like, but come back to me, come back to me. And it can be real messy. Yeah. Right, love me. Oh God, it's messy. And then finally we have the fearful avoidant type, which to me at least maps onto disorganized styles in children. And those are the ones that might be described as more erratic. And so those are folks that have a little bit of everything going on. They want to get close to you, but also want to run away. They have high anxiety, but also high avoidance. And usually those are ones where as children, the caregivers that they had access to were both the source of comfort and also the source of fear. Mm-hmm. And that can be that the parent or the caregiver was abusive. It can mean that the parent or caregiver was themselves abused and so was sometimes available for connection, but other times also really scared and insecure and anxious themselves. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of this, you know, when people are mapping themselves out, I ask them to not just look at From this description, what do you resonate with? But also, if we're talking about your environment growing up, what do you resonate with? Were you in a household where your caregiver was maybe both a source of fear and care? Was your caregiver someone who was all up in your business all the time? Was your caregiver someone who was very distant and not emotionally available? And to dig a little bit deeper, the reason I didn't realize, frankly, that I was in a dismissive, avoidant kind of attachment style was because my superficial understanding at the time was that people with dismissive avoidance styles had parents that were distant. And I was like, no, my parents were all up in my cheese fries all the time. Totally not that. And when I deepened my understanding of attachment, I was like, oh, they were actually there. They were very emotionally there up to a point. And there were certain emotions that we did not deal with. There were certain emotions, especially anger, that we dealt with in to what I consider very unhealthy ways now. And they were not emotionally there for me with stuff around my sexuality and other things that mattered a lot to me. And so they were distant, just not in every way. And so that why it was hard for me at the beginning to realize, oh, this is my style and this is how my parents were distant. They weren't distant completely, but in ways that really, really mattered. So if someone doesn't feel like they completely fit into one style or they don't entirely resonate, that's okay. This idea, this theory is just a guide, you know, something to be helpful. And if it's not working for you, then you don't have to use it. But if it's kind of fitting, but not entirely, I just encourage people to dig a little bit deeper, and get a little bit more information to see if maybe they're missing something that would help them connect more if they knew it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent.
One of the things I found really interesting is how you talked about how, like, you, looking back on your childhood, it may not look exactly like what they describe the childhood of someone with that, like, attachment type necessarily looking like at first glance. For myself, I think I resonate very much with fearful or the combined type. I'm sorry, you said the name again. It changes in every article and book I read.
The anxious preoccupied,
yes,
maybe?
You. And yeah, and I've seen a lot of it associated with, like, abusive childhoods, and I definitely would not characterize my childhood that way. But I thought about it a little more, and recognized that, like, my mom is a survivor of a lot of trauma, and, during my childhood, among, like, processing a lot of stuff that happened before I was born, she also had a couple of big things happen to her in that time, and has struggled with mental illness and was deeply depressed during parts of my childhood. But also, all she's ever wanted to be is that, like, June Cleaver, Leave It to Beaver mom, like, that has all the kids from the neighborhood and makes all the food for them. So when she was there, she was on. I had, you know, themed birthday parties where she'd decorate the whole house and invent games for it and everything. But there were also times where she couldn't get out of bed. And looking back and being able to, like, recognize the differences and the ways that I learned to, like, bond and turn to her when I needed her for things, but also recognize that, like, nope, sometimes I do my own shit and it's fine and I can take care of myself and I don't have to worry about a goddamn thing, which is not super healthy approach to adulthood.
And it makes sense. Yeah. Right? Like, the thing that I think I try to hammer in as much as I can in these conversations is it makes sense, right? And the thing that we have to learn is the ways that we learned to survive as children or teenagers or what have you are not always the best ways we can learn to survive as adults. And this is also a conversation about abuse, right? Yeah. The core of some of these attachment styles and attachment style interruptions are abuse related or trauma related. And there are so many different ways that abuse can manifest. It's not just about being physically beaten or assaulted. There's also neglect, emotional distance. There's, you know, untreated mental illness that results in parents not connecting with their kids at all or being punted from family member to family member to family member. And so I think part of why this discussion can be really scary and hard for a lot of people is that it kind of forces them to contend with their history mm-hmm. in ways that they're not always ready for. Mm-hmm. And it forces them to critically look at what they experienced as children that they may be, for, again, for totally understandable reasons, punted off and didn't want to think about. And for me, this has led to me digging into my family history real deep, finding some real scandalous information. And, you know, one of the great things about it to me too, though, has been being able to better empathize with my family, better able to recognize why they did the things that they did. I saw that, you know, as a trained therapist, I was like, there seem to be some very interesting reactions here and ways that we deal with conflict that to me signal trauma, but no one is talking about it. I wonder what's going on. And, you know, the more I dug, the more I realized, oh, there was a lot of stuff here. We just were extremely not talking about it. But even if we weren't talking about it, the reverberations of it were felt, which is another call for, to me anyway, transparency and honesty around this. Because even when we try to suppress, even when we try to hide, even when we keep secrets, even when we say, nothing to see here, please move along, the stuff comes out. It just always does. It's just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And so we can choose to, you know, let the ticking time bomb tick away until some unknown time in the future, or we can decide, okay, I don't want to just leave that up to chance. I actually want to be the person who decides when this goes off and how it goes off. And to me, that feels like a way more empowering approach, which is why, again, I encourage people to actually try to give themselves the space and resources to dig into this rather than just letting it happen, which in itself, right, is related to attachment. I know that based on how I was raised, I have been very like confident, go, let's make it happen, let's do it. And for other people, what they've learned is you survive by just waiting it out. You survive by not pushing it. You survive by making sure that everyone around you is okay first. And maybe then you get to focus on yourself. Mm-hmm. So it's, this is really messy and complicated. And, you know, what I want listeners to take away is this is not going to be done in one day. This is not going to be done in 1 hour. This is a lifelong process that I'm asking them to engage in, but for very good reasons, right? Because I want them to have the healthiest relationships they can. I want them to be the best, happiest versions of themselves that they can be, the ones that can feel the widest array of emotions. And, you know, we can't do that in one day, obviously.
Yeah. Well, and I also think part of what's important about, like, examining this stuff is recognizing that sometimes it's the result of people being shitty to you in your past, and sometimes it's the result of shitty circumstances just existing. This is, we're getting all into my family issues this week, which I guess I should have known going into it. But this is also, this is a conversation I had with my mom recently that was like, no, just because less than ideal things happen or I've developed less than ideal coping mechanisms, it's a product of a situation we were both put in and we both did our best to survive. And there are things I still have to work on. And it's not necessarily a failing on anyone's part, and being able to find that compassion for myself and for my mom, who was in that situation with me, was really helpful. And I know it's not great for every situation, but in many situations, it can be helpful to recognize that, like, sometimes things just suck, and everyone's doing their best.
Yes. And that can be really hard, especially if you've been hurt by someone and you're trying to find the ability to be compassionate toward them.
Yeah.
And we're not ready to do that immediately, right? And again, that's where attachment comes in. For some people, the way that they deal with their pain, especially if we're thinking of like anxious, preoccupied attachment, those are the folks that do a lot of reassurance seeking, have more nervous energy, like I said. And because they want to connect so, so deeply, they are often really good listeners. They're often the people who are watching everyone and like how they're doing, and they might be the first to apologize or the first to connect, or, you know, they have, those are superpowers to some extent, right? All of these have their superpowers and their cons. And if you're someone who's trying to extend compassion to a caregiver or to someone who's hurt you, and you're, say, more dismissive avoidant, you might have a harder time doing that right off the bat, because for you, what's more comfortable is disconnecting. For you, it is more comfortable to go off by yourself and be like, you suck, you hurt me, peace, never see me again. And that's also not in the long run super healthy, just like dismissing your own needs and just focusing on other people is also not healthy in the long run. But we will have these different responses. And so for the folks who are more dismissive or avoidant, they have to generally work on connection. The anxious, preoccupied people generally have to work on disconnection or boundary setting. Mm-hmm. And the folks who are more fearful, avoidant have to kind of work on both, which is really tricky. They have to work on a balance of regulation so that they don't feel and behave in ways that are really unpredictable to them and the people around them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I've been through this process or started to try to start this process with like a few different therapists. And it seemed like often the advice I was given as like an anxiously attached person was like, try to give yourself the reassurance that you wish a partner would give to you, which for me would often look like reviewing evidence in kind of like a CBT sort of style of like how much they like me and like how attractive I am to them and stuff like that. But it's really a difficult process, I'm sure, for anybody of any attachment style to like go against what feels most natural and also what feels the safest and to try to do something else.
Totally. And you're hitting a great point here, which is the question of distress tolerance. Mm-hmm. And distress tolerance is, or the window of tolerance, as you know, some trauma therapists talk about it. It's this idea that there is a set of things that you can be distressed by and you can handle, and things that fall outside of that window or outside of that scope are going to flip your shit. And sometimes what happens is that people have a really, really narrow window of tolerance. And so it doesn't take very much to make them flip their shit. And sometimes people have such a wide window of tolerance that it is very hard for them to ever state a boundary because everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. It's fine. And so the things that each people need to do will vary depending on where they are, right? Is your window too big? Is your window too small? Are you too reassurance seeking, you know, quote unquote, mm-hmm. too reassurance seeking, not connected enough? And that's why, you know, that's why it makes sense to me, at least, to encourage people to find out their style, right? Because there's a question of why do I need to even care about this? Mm-hmm. Because if you know a little bit more about your style or the style that's most common for you, right, that you work around or against or with, you can then figure out, okay, what are the antidotes, right? What are the things that then I need to work on, at least for now, mm-hmm. right? Because there's also this question of, are you doomed to have the same attachment style for the rest of your life? No. Can you have attachment styles that are different with different people? Yes. That said, generally there's one that kind of surfaces over and over, and as creatures that recognize patterns, that's what I'm asking us to do. See, okay, which one's the usual one that comes through? Which is the one that when I'm the most freaked out, I usually revert to, right? When my coping skills are low, when I am really tired, what do I tend to do? That's also the one that kind of state gives us a little bit of a better insight into what's the style that we have, because it's about survival, right? We try to survive, and what circumstances or situations put us in that place of, I need to survive right now, I just need to survive, those are the ones that can give us a little bit more information about, oh, when I get really, really freaked out, I just want to run towards someone. Or when I get really freaked out, I want to be left the fuck alone. Or I have no idea, it's a toss-up, right? So that's another way that people can figure out which one generally comes up or they're leaning into. Think of yourself in your most scared moments, in your most nervous, most low bandwidth times. What do you tend to do when you're in a conflict? What do you tend to do with the people around you?
Mm-hmm. And as you were talking about that, I could like feel it in me when you were like, oh, when I feel really distressed, I go to people. I was like, oh God, no. Like, like every cell of my being was like, no, put me alone in my room. Like, I feel like that's true for a lot of people. Whereas like you can feel in your body what like you're wanting in that moment or what like feels most mm-hmm. natural to you.
Right. And people's different, you know, well, especially when we talk about non-monogamy, because a lot of these books are really, really, really monogamy-centric, which grinds my gears. you can have different attachment style manifestations, right? Even if your style itself changes, doesn't change, I don't super care about that as much as how does it manifest, right? I have some relationships where I manifest the hell out of secure attachment, and it's beautiful. And when we have conflict, I know how to be secure in the attachment, even if my, you know, my original operating system in my meat computer was avoidant. Mm-hmm. I have installed secure attachment, and by golly, I will freaking have it. And, you know, different partners, I think part of what's beautiful actually, and super annoying, but also really beautiful about having multiple partnerships in a very intentional way and in a very sort of connected way, is that it can give us opportunities to see what it would look like if we had to deal with conflict differently and if we had different mirrors for conflict. Mm-hmm. So I have tended to partner with people that are more anxious and are more connection seeking than I am, which can be a volatile mix, right? Because if they want to connect and I want to get the hell away from them, that can be challenging. But that is also a really beautiful gift, because the thing that they have something to teach me and I have something to teach them, mm-hmm. right? One of the partners that I've had for about a decade this month, actually, happy anniversary to Ian. Mm-hmm. he has taught me to be sad. He has taught me to be gentle with my emotions. He has taught me to listen to them, that it's okay that they're there. And that it's okay for me to not just like hold everything really, really tightly and be very intellectual about it through these like last 10 years that we've been together. And for him, I know that what he said is that I've taught him to be more collected and to be more sort of emotionally organized and to have a higher tolerance for exploring by himself and tolerating his own distress. Mm-hmm. So even when that combo of the anxious and the avoidant people can be really, really volatile, it can be amazing if you work on it and if you see what you're doing and dedicate yourselves to it. And so that's been something that's been really helpful for me. I have other partnerships where their form of their attachment or the way that it manifests really clashes with me in a way that I wasn't necessarily expecting, or where their tendencies to manage the situations really press my buttons in a way that's hard. And that's just another opportunity for growth, I would say. It's another way to see, oh, this is how I interact in this situation. How can I grow to work on this better? Or how can I grow to keep this relationship healthy? How can I grow to keep a boundary here? How can I grow to, you know, distance myself from things that are not actually healthy though? Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about non-monogamy or more expansive views of relationships, to me, it's all just a series of opportunities, right? A series of ways that we can experiment with different selves, experiment with different ways of dealing and see how it feels. Does it feel good? Does it feel bad? Just because it feels bad doesn't mean it's bad. How do I, you know, move through the world with greater understanding or empathy for other people who might also be dealing with this kind of thing? So even though the literature doesn't talk a lot about non-monogamy or a lot about more collectivist cultures generally, it's very, you know, couple heavy and monogamy heavy. I think it's a way that we can just look at how to be better people with each other, no matter how many relationships we're in at any given time.
Yeah. One thing I think is really interesting about the way you talk about all this is how you talk about how you had like this baseline operating system and you've kind of learned the skills that go with secure attachment. And it sounds a lot like, in the way you describe this, it sounds a lot like secure attachment is something, is more of an active process and is something more done like through the work of learning relationships. And I don't know if I'm like mischaracterizing that, but I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about moving towards more secure styles of relationship.
Totally. I mean, this relates to what I said earlier. I'm like, have I ever really met anyone with secure attachment? When you really get down to it, yeah. I don't know. And part of it is because I think that the world that we live in right now is not built for secure attachment.
It's not.
We live in a world where there's quick, you know, ecological disaster. current and in the future. Mm-hmm. We live in a world where capitalism is the law of many lands. We live in a world where there's rampant oppression, right? Like, that in itself is completely antithetical to secure attachment, right? How can you be chill? How mm-hmm. can you build intimacy with ease if you and your communities are getting assaulted regularly?
The world like, I just is don't literally burning.
Like, yes, I'm like, I don't think mm-hmm. that the world is set up for this. And we have to kind of sometimes just claw it out of the burning world that we're in. Uh-huh. And to me, I think that you're spot on, right? In the at least again, in the way that I interpret it and the way that I work with it,
yeah.
secure attachment to me is more of a process and more of a thing that we strive to rather than a thing that we are just handed down. Mm-hmm. And if we're trying to move to more secure attachment, right, there are some basic skills that everyone generally needs, and you just tweak it depending on your style. It's really important to get a sense of how to feel your fucking feelings is a big one. And
don't call me out
what
like
I
this.
Mean by that. I'm here to be
we invite you on my
guest.
Show, and then you're rude to me
you
like
come
this.
To my podcast. Yeah, no, seriously. Because for some people, you know, they feel their feelings and they are overwhelmed by them. And I'm not even talking here about mental illness or mental health issues or diagnoses. I'm talking about feelings sometimes are overwhelming, and that's real. Some people struggle with that more than others. Some people struggle with that seasonally, whatever. Mm-hmm. But feeling our feelings and getting a sense of how we can deal with them is really hard, especially when there are feelings that we've been taught are bad or feelings that we shouldn't be feeling. And so one of the things that is really important for just good relationships in general, never mind attachment, is getting closer to the feelings that you were told to stay away from. So if you are told or taught, right, because sometimes this is not overtly said, it is just how things are. Anger is bad or sadness is bad. In this family, we don't cry. In this family, we argue and then we go to our rooms and then we pretend like nothing ever happened and we never say sorry. Those are all things that affect how we deal with relationships as adults and what we think is okay to do and not okay to do. So for example, with this partner that I've been with for 10 years, I didn't realize how violent my silence could be. Because I grew up in a household where it was more likely that the person I was arguing with, which was usually my mom, we would be screaming at each other. Mm-hmm. And my dad was the quiet one. So the way that I learned to deal with my mom's rage and her loudness was to be stone-faced, to act like nothing bothered me, and to quote-unquote win by allowing her to look like the crazy one. Which, again, I say totally on purpose because that word is stigmatized and, like, that's how my brain was working at the time, right? I was like, mm-hmm. you look nuts and this is how I win and stay safe as mm-hmm. a teenager or as a child. And I didn't realize that being silent was also something that could be really triggering or activating for someone else who grew up in a household where silence was more of the weapon, or where passive aggressiveness was more of the weapon. And so what I had to learn through our work together as a couple and even couples therapy was, oh, my nervous system is really activated by my partner being loud. Their nervous system is really activated by me being like cold and murderous looking. And the way that my brain interpreted it was, well, I'm not doing anything. Like, I'm here silent. Like, what are you complaining about? And I had to shut up and learn that silence was actually really another tool, right, that I was actively using and could be really painful for someone else. And so I needed to be able to feel my anger and befriend it in a different way and get out of this mindset of who wins and who doesn't win. I had to lean into the trust that I had with that partner, that I could have my feelings and express them and not have to be so cold and quiet. And they had to learn how to be a little bit more quiet, you know, a little bit less, I'm trying to find the word. It's not coming to me, but like less flaily with their feelings. And so if there's feelings that you were taught to divorce yourself from, figure out a way to make friends with them. And I know that's easier said than done, right? I'm actually going to be publishing a thing on my blog very shortly. So probably by the time this is out, it should be up there, which is all about how to feel those feelings. Also learning why it's important to feel those feelings. I know that I grew up, you know, fairly intellectual and more into the brain than the body. And so I was like, why should I feel those feelings? Feelings sound inconvenient. Wouldn't it be cooler if we were all robots when we didn't have to deal with any of those pesky human emotions?
Exactly.
But I can rationalize myself out of all of these feelings. Why have them?
Right. Right. And feelings are actually really, really important for a lot of reasons. I'm not even going to get into the whole spectrum of them here, but feelings are actually a way that we can build community. They're a way that gives us information about what our bodies need and what our bodies are scared of. Feelings are a way that we can connect. Feelings are a way that we can discharge certain things from our bodies and process them better so that they don't become toxic in the long run. You know, the impact of chronic stress and suppressing chronic stress is bananas, right? If you actually look into the long-term effects of chronic stress on the body, it basically hits every system of your body and is super alarming. And how many of us are taught to suppress our stress, to just deal with it, to just get to work, not think about how badly we feel.
Not only right? that, and so, but like,
exactly.
Right now we're taught to wear it like a badge of honor. I mean, I'm also millennial living in New York, but like, I think everywhere, late stage capitalism, you're supposed to be stressed. That means you're working. That means you're following right. your passions and getting things done.
Right. Again, that's enough. I'm just like, don't get me started, Beth. Don't get me started. But yeah, the idea that we have to be chronically underslept and overworked and tired as a way to be good activists or be good in the world. And honestly, a lot of that comes from not just capitalism, but this idea that we have to pay to be on Earth, that we have to apologize for existing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's actually what it boils down to for a lot of people. It's, I have to do all this to earn my keep on the planet because, you know, I'm sorry I was born, or I feel like a burden, or I feel like no one actually cares about me, or if I actually trust people, they're going to let me down. And so I need to do all this work to make sure that that doesn't happen. You know, when we boil down to a lot of these things, it's just, we're scared. We're so scared so often. Even the cockiest people, it's just, there's so much fear. There's so much pain that is often not processed. And so to build towards more secure attachment, we have to learn how to feel our feelings in healthier ways. We need to learn how to have better boundaries with work and with ourselves and with our partners. There's this woman named Marie Forleo who had, I don't know if it's still online, but she was putting this PDF of how to say no on her website. Mm. And to be fair, it's a cis white lady. Not everything is going to be applicable to everyone, but she has these scripts of how to say no to a lot of different people in your life that I've sent to a lot of folks who've struggled with it because they don't have the words or they don't have examples of how to say no in ways that feel okay or gracious. And just having examples of sentences can be really life-changing. To also build better attachment, getting acquainted with and familiar with the difference between an emergency that is externally relevant to other people besides yourself and an emergency that is mostly only internally relevant and gives you a sense of urgency is really important. Because sometimes we feel like, oh, this is the most important thing in the world, and no one else around us feels that. And so we feel like we need to act out the urgency or make others understand how urgent it is in ways that are not super healthy. And vice versa. There are times when we see other people's urgency and because it doesn't resonate for us, we tend to minimize it. And we tend to say, you know, calm down. It's not that big of a deal. It's not that big of a deal. And again, we can map this onto attachment style. Generally, the dismissive, avoidant people are the minimizers. The anxious, preoccupied folks are the maximizers, which is why often in relationships, you'll find someone, you know, trying to be heard in their pain and the other person downplaying it, and vice versa. And so that's another piece that relates to giving ourselves room to rest, room to make sense of our past, and some grace and compassion when we're just trying to practice these things that maybe we weren't taught and feel completely wrong, right? Like when I work with couples, sometimes I just directly say, I'm going to ask you to do things in this room and at home that feel viscerally, entirely wrong. And I need you to trust me that I know what I'm talking about and that I'm giving this to you for a reason, which I can also explain, but I'm going to need you to trust me that this is for the betterment of your relationship because it's going to feel so viscerally wrong. And if people are prepared for that, it allows them a little bit more room to try it out because they don't have the alarm bell going off in their head that says, danger, 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 this is wrong. You should stop right the fuck now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you talk about internal versus external emergencies, it reminded me a lot of how we often talk about jealousy in non-monogamy and how there's like kind of a split between like people who think that you should like process it all and like talk it all out with your partners versus like processing it yourself on your own time. I think like probably the ideal is like somewhere in between, but it raises a question for me, like since you're talking about how like so many of these attachment theory resources are really monogamy focused, like can you speak to how attachment theory plays into polyamory and like how the traditional advice about attachment theory might be different for poly folks?
Yes. So there's a lot about the sacred bond of the couple and neutralizing any external threat to that, which is dicey if you have multiple relationships going on at the same time. And so the way that some books talk about it, and actually in another podcast that I did, I mentioned Wired for Love by Stan Tatkin, which has some really cool stuff in there, slightly different language for attachment styles than I used here, but has a lot on the neurobiology, which is great, but is extremely, extremely monogamy heavy. And the way that they talk about it is the focus on the couple is kind of an antidote to an individualist mindset of people only focusing on themselves. And they encourage you in this book and in other literature pieces to think of yourselves as a unit and to mm-hmm. think of the couple rather than the individual needs, which is really smart in many ways, because especially for those of us raised maybe in the United States under the United States kind of white supremacy bullshit, a lot of it is individualism. A lot of it is you got you, no one else, you ahead of others, like just focus on yourself. And that can be an antidote, the idea of thinking of the couple rather than the individual. But I think we can expand that even further and we can be more collectivist about it and think, okay, if I'm not just thinking about my own needs, if I'm not just thinking about the couple needs, I can think about the group needs, the larger community needs. And we, at least in my eyes, we need to look at all those different levels. We can't just do one to the detriment of the other, because all of them are in existence and all of them are different degrees of importance. And so when we think about polyamory and attachment, not just thinking about what is most important to the couple, but how does that impact the other people in important relationships to that couple? There's also the ideas that, you know, and this, again, Stan Tatkin talks about this couple bubble and protecting the couple bubble, to, you know, also getting to trash talk non-monogamy as a way that insecure attachment manifests, right? There's a lot of therapists out there that say, oh, people who are non-monogamous are just insecurely attached and doing a bad job at dealing with it. And I don't think that's true. And I don't think that it's entirely untrue. I think that for a lot of people, their pull towards non-monogamy is a really interesting adaptation to maybe some challenges that they face around attachment. Because for someone, for example, who's more avoidant, they might be polyamorous in a way to make sure that they do have some connection, but that they keep it so spread out that it doesn't become threatening and scary. For people who are more anxiously attached, maybe their version of non-monogamy is such so that they have a lot of different kinds of reassurance to deal with the distress of not having the reassurance from one singular partner all the time. And I don't think that that's bad. Right? The idea that we have to have one source of security, one place of attachment, I think is bogus in the first place. And at the same time, right, I don't think we can discount the idea that some of the ways that we do non-monogamy are kind of dicey and might need some tweaking. Mm-hmm. So any time that someone comes to this discussion as, no, non-monogamy is perfect and you can't call us insecurely attached, or the opposite of, no, you're all insecurely attached and terrible. I'm just like, ugh, I'm tired of both of y'all. Like, can we just not? Can we just say, it's a little bit of both. It's more complicated. Let's now dig into it and actually deal with it rather than flinging mud at both sides and being so close-minded. And so, you know, when we talk about how to implement this theory and implement it into our non-monogamous relationships, I encourage people to go broad, right? Don't just think about how you attach to the people that you're maybe having sex with or romantic with or whatever. Think about your friends. How do you attach to those friends? Who are the friends that you seek in times of trouble? Whose trouble distresses you, right? Who do you go to if you need to regulate your feelings or your mood, or if you're really freaked out? Who are the people that you go to if you want to have an adventure? Like, I just encourage people to look at the ways that they bond with and seek safety with and through other relationships that are not ones they are necessarily counting as the romantic or sexual ones. Because I think that can just help broaden our perspective on how we build in any relationship and how these things come through. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. Yeah, that was my main soapbox, frankly. It's an interesting adaptation, and we're just doing our best. We're trying to do our best and move away from there's only one way to do it right kind of mentality.
Yeah, I think that's really wise. We have like a few minutes left, and I really wanted to ask you about kink because, as I mentioned, like that is one of the main things that I've seen you speak about. I think that you speak about it really eloquently. And we wondered if you had any thoughts about power exchange and insecure attachment. Like, I'm sure that there are people who would argue that you can't ethically do power exchange if you are insecurely attached. But like, how do you think about those two things being connected or not?
Again, I would say, like, it's trash if someone is just, well, you can never do this. I'm like, first of all, what are your ethics? They might not be my ethics. You don't know me.
It reminds me of SSC people who talk about sane being a pre-qualifier for kink, where it's like, right, all right, exactly. None of us are there. Let's be honest. Like,
right.
Like, we all have a ton of shit. The best we can do is be consciously aware of our shit going into it.
Right. God, no. Yeah, I hate that. I hate the, oh, you have to be sane. I was like, so if people have a mental illness that's chronic and lifelong, they can never safely engage in kink, get out.
I had to yell at someone at a kink workshop recently who was teaching. I was like, I'm just going to gently push back on all this stuff you're saying. Just throw that out there.
Right. And I mean, something else to keep in mind, right, is some people have been lucky enough and privileged enough, because it's not just about luck, it's sometimes about privilege, to not have, you know, deep trauma in their childhood, or to not have deep loss in their childhood and or their life. And that is, it's just a matter of time, which maybe sounds creepy and really morbid, but it's just a matter of time before trauma touches your life. And arguably, some communities will never not be touched by trauma given their position in the social ladder and, you know, the societies that we live in. And the better we get at recognizing and dealing with this early, and the better skills we develop to deal with distress, to deal with trauma, to deal with discomfort, the better we're going to be. And this is honestly why a lot of my work is moving me in the direction of working with more and more cis men, because a lot of them have not been aware of the traumas that they have faced, or have not faced certain kinds of traumas that a lot of other communities have faced and have learned to try to cope with. And so when they hit them in adulthood, they lose their mind and they don't know what to do. And sometimes they resort to violence as a way to deal with it. And I think that if we had better, you know, skills and skill building opportunities for folks overall to deal with distress, it would actually do a lot to change how much violence exists in our world. It's obviously not the only thing or the only solution. It's way more complicated than that, but that feels like one of them. And so when we talk about kink and DS, we're going to do it regardless. Like, it's not, you're not going to wait for this like magical moment where everything is perfect and now you're completely sane and now you can have kinky sex. That's not going to happen. And it's not a realistic thing to expect. So that said, ethical playing with power exchange, first things first is, what are your ethics, right? Like, your ethics might be different from mine. Your values might be different from mine. So first off is, get clear with what your ethics and what your values are, if you're going to be saying you're being ethical about anything. That said, though, I'm actually really a fan of, consensually, using kind of therapeutic homework as DS homework.
Yes.
There are definitely things that I have told... I laugh because my clients know I'm kinky, and sometimes it just extremely comes out in session in hilarious ways. we're like, we know what's happening. It's fine. There are clients where one of the interventions that we've used has been them bragging about themselves in session. And that's been really helpful for folks who have a lot of negative self-talk, who are constantly putting themselves down, or who have a hard time acknowledging their own overcoming of obstacles. And so, you know, there's some folks where I'm like, all right, every session we will begin with three brags about things that you did that you kicked butt at. And sometimes it's, I woke up and got to therapy, and that's okay, right? Mm-hmm. But the question that goes with it is, and why was this specifically a brag, right? Because sometimes people will try to bullshit you, and I'm not here for it. But that's something that can be done in a kink setting as well, right? Think of a dominant telling their submissive, hey, every time we have a date, I want you to say three nice things about yourself. And it can seem mm-hmm. extremely corny, and I totally get it. And there's research on this in terms of being able to more easily internalize those messages the more you repeat them and the more you repeat them out loud and if you're witnessed. So three tends to be the magic number, repeating things like three times, saying them out loud if you can, or having them mirrored in some way. And let me tell you, every person that I've done that with in therapy has gotten so much better at positive self-talk and reducing their negative self-talk. It's amazing. And it mm-hmm. takes them different, you know, it's different timelines for each person. But that's something that can be very easily incorporated into kink. Some people have a praise kink that can also very neatly overlap with that. So if you're a dominant who, you know, wants to give homework, you can do the homework thing. If you yourself have a praise kink or your submissive has a praise kink, you can use praise as a way to deepen attachment. There's so many ways that you can kind of put in good relationship behaviors and build them into a dynamic that the list is just impossible to enumerate at this point. Mm-hmm. But other ideas are also around having boundaries, right? If someone has a really hard time stating their boundaries, you can figure out a way to insert that into your DS. And sometimes that means, okay, I know that you have a hard time with boundaries. Our DS negotiation or our DS contract will never include a lack of a safe word, or I will specifically do scenes with you where the point is that you will safe word and we will stop, right? Like, I don't want the scene to end without the safe word happening, because I need you to exercise your right to say no. And we need to be able to trust each other that we will have that safe word moment, rather than, oh, if I'm good, it means that I will never use my safe word. In DS, it's also not just about the submissive, right? If a dominant is the person who's struggling with some of these things, and they either get really distant or they seek a lot of reassurance, you can also play with that in the moment and get a sense of, okay, you know, if the dominant needs space for themselves in a conflict, but they need to work on that, they or their submissive or someone has identified that they need to better connect, they can also try to experiment with their submissive giving them physical contact. So, hey, we just had a conflict, and what we've arranged is that after a conflict, we will have a 15-minute break. We'll check back in. We can have another break if needed. Then we come back, and we will have 5 minutes of holding hands mm-hmm. when we come back together. Or they will have 5 minutes of their submissive rubbing their feet or what have you. And as long as you know what the things that you're trying to work on are, you can very easily embed them, and creatively actually embed them into kink in ways that are also, you know, not just affirming of attachment stuff, but also gender, yeah. right? Like there's folks where there's gendered words that they don't get affirmed with on the daily. They might be closeted, they might be trans and, you know, not out to a lot of folks, but in a kink setting, they can bring that in and they can actually use that. The biggest conversation though that I have with my friends, partners, and clients is this kink playing into the patterns that are already unhealthy and reinforcing those, or is it trying to reinforce things that are healthier for you? And that to me is one of the big differences between healthier and unhealthier kink. When you're being demeaned, for example, and if that gets you really hot, do you generally have a problem with being demeaned? Are you already demeaning yourself a lot? Then maybe let's be thoughtful about the ways that that shows up in your kink life, because it might be just a repetition of an unhealthy pattern that you have in other parts of your life, rather than this like randomly hot thing that for no reason just gets you really hard or wet. So, my advice when working with kink around this or using kink is, again, just be thoughtful, try to dig into what you're doing and why. How would it feel different if you tweaked it? Right? If you change this a little bit, would it feel less erotic or more erotic? Why do you think that might be? And just being curious and staying curious, I think, is the main piece around this for sure. And having other people, ideally, that you can touch base with. Abuse, trauma, all these like sort of rough things thrive in isolation and secrecy. And the more we can build community, the more we can build connections to reality test each other and keep each other safe, the better we're all going to be and the less abuse we will have in our communities.
Thank you. That's a lot of wisdom.
Yeah.
Just a lot. Thank you so much. I honestly feel like we could talk to you for like hours and hours more. You have so much to say on this. It's great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I love how you talked about kink. It's just ability to kind of give context to work on whatever you want to work on and how it can be malleable and you can kind of craft it to serve you in the ways you need it to. I think that's really powerful. And it's honestly one of my favorite things about kink.
It's a tool, right? Yeah. It's a tool, and how you use it is up to you, and what you do with it is up to you. And I think getting rid of this idea that it is either safe or unsafe, healthy or unhealthy, like is deeply important, because it's not, it's never generally that black and white. And when we try to organize our lives by just picking from two boxes, I'm sure some of you can relate. It doesn't really allow us to be our happiest, most authentic selves.
What do you mean binaries are bad?
Moving away from this like one or the other. What? Hot take. Binaries are trash. Let's think of ranges. Let's think of percentages. Let's think of things that are a little bit, you can still have the binary if it's useful, but maybe it's 20% of this binary or closer to this end.
I just want my foot in this box.
Either have my hand in the other go or all systems not.
Was there anything you didn't get to say, Ida, that you wanted to?
Let me see. There's, context basically is one of the main things that tells us if an attachment style is secure, insecure, or adaptive or maladaptive. Mm-hmm. And so we can't think of any of these things outside of context, which I think is, one thing that I hammered in overall. But as far as closing words, context matters so, so much to this. There's a quote from Esther Perel, who does a lot of research on infidelity and monogamy and all this stuff, that says, the more we're able to trust, the further we're able to venture. And all of this is trust work and trauma work and grief work. And both some of us are very deeply unprepared to do it, and most of us are more prepared than sometimes we give ourselves credit for. We've been in our bodies for however many years, and we've been surviving thus far. We didn't just get there out of pure accident or luck. There's definitely social factors that contributed, but there's personal factors too. Like, we got to where we are for various reasons, and it's important that we give ourselves credit for all the ways we've managed to survive. And just because we have to change or might want to consider changing some of the ways that we've survived doesn't mean that they didn't make sense at the time or that they were bad at the time. Mm-hmm. And again, it comes back to this question of being compassionate with not only our current and future selves, but our past selves, right? We did what we did. Let's understand why and how we can move forward, but without trash talking that older version of ourselves. We have more time in the future to make it right if we need to, or to change it if we need to. And giving that compassion to ourselves is a key part of it.
Mm-hmm. Ida, thank you so much for joining us and for just all of this wisdom. There's just so much to think about. I don't normally take notes while we have guests on, but I was taking a lot of notes. So thank you. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to see more of you?
I'm, as I always say, I'm ridiculously and upsettingly at times easy to find on the internet, as long as you have my name. So my website is AIDAMANDULE.com. Basically, it's AIDAMANDULE.com. I'm Neuron Bomb on Twitter, AIDAMANDULE on Instagram. And just, you know, easy to find. And also, that is a huge compliment, to have people write notes. I love it when that happens. So I'm feeling really joyous that happened. And I'm excited to see where you take those notes and kind of, you know, how this evolves in people's lives. That's part of the reason I yell so much about it.
Yep. Okay, great. Thank you. I am Kate Sloan. I am at girly_juice on Twitter and Instagram. And, God, sorry. What do I normally even say here?
I don't know. I was just going through mine. I was like, oh, God, I have to close the show. I'm thinking about so many other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a sex blog at girlyjuice.net, and I host another podcast that is called Question Box. Where is your stuff, friend?
I'm Bex. You can find all my writing at BexTalkSex.com, and I'm on Twitter and Instagram at BexTalkSex. Together we're the Dildorks. We're on Twitter and Instagram at The Dildorks and at TheDildorks.com. You could also find us by searching The Dildorks in your favorite podcast app, and by going to Patreon.com/TheDildorks to toss a couple of bucks our way.
Thank you to Protodome for doing our theme song. Thank you to Amy for doing our logo, and thank you to you for listening. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, Ida. That was so fun.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Ida, you're just saying, like, so many smart things that I keep forgetting what questions I was going to ask, because I'm just, like, struck speechless by smart thoughts.